Welcome to today's edition of Invest Africa Insights, the leading business intelligence service brought to you by Invest Africa.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Invest Africa Insights. Joining me today, I have Gonzalo Neves Correa, CEO of Third Way Africa. Gonzalo, thank you for joining us today and welcome to the podcast. For a bit of background on you founded Third Way Africa in 2014 around a new paradigm for investment in emerging markets, which places community and the environment at the heart of investment decision-making. Since then, Third Way has worked across the business and government spectrum to create and mobilise innovative financing for sustainable development with a focus on rural communities, agriculture and conservation. So I hope that's a sort of fair introduction to Third Way Africa. But perhaps to kick us off, you can explain a little bit more about your Third Way of investing and what that means.
No, absolutely. And thanks again, Eleanor, for the introduction. So as you said, we started the firm in 2014. And just to remind our audience a little bit of context here, this was pre-SDGs, which got launched at the end of 2015, as well as the Paris Climate Agreement, COP21, at the end of 2015. So at the time, we had an investment community that was starting to be interested in impact investing. The term had already been coined for a number of years. But it was, you know, in the grand scheme of things, still relatively early days. Myself and my co-founding partner, Alejandro Tawil, we started the firm specifically in Africa, as the name says. We both had personal histories in the continent, in particular in Southern Africa, and in particular in Mozambique. And when we came together to start the firm, we did so with an investment aspiration. That's ultimately what we wanted to be and to facilitate, you know, to bring more capital into the continent and more responsible capital and capital that would sort of catalyze and sustain businesses for the long run. And what we saw at the time was that there were kind of two distinct pools of funding that historically hadn't really worked too much with each other. On the one hand, you had the development community primarily expressing itself, if you will, in the form of aid to a number of these economies, but working largely in a silo and not collaborating as much with the private sector and with commercial capital. And the issue that would potentially have in the medium term was that there was no real exit strategy for a lot of these donor programs. Once the grants, the aid sort of funding would stop, there was no real continuity in sight. And then on the other hand, you had, call it adventurous investors, largely coming to invest in the continent in sort of equity, buying stakes in different sort of projects, largely interested in real assets because that gave people a sense of collateral, you know, whether it's mining, natural resources, forestry, agriculture. And under this investment thesis that for not a lot of initial capital, you could own a lot of effectively that real asset. And with a sense that these investments were going to yield, you know, multiple turns on the initial capital, you know, they were going to be 10x type of investments. And then, you know, over time, the realization that actually the asset management component, the investment management component was much harder than people thought. And this ultimately led to, you know, investor fatigue and assets that at a certain point in time started to become stranded and not able to attract further capital. And so Third Way really came from the philosophy that we thought converging or blending these two types of funding made a lot of sense. Of course, some countries also had domestic capital pools, some more than others, and that was also part of our initial thinking. But the name Third Way really came from this idea of converging Wall Street and Development Street into the same project. And I must say that it's been a fascinating journey. And clearly, post 2015, you know, with the launch of the SDGs and the Paris Climate Agreement, obviously the appetite for those two communities to work with each other has, you know, has grown exponentially.
Yeah, sounds like your timing was spot on. So if I were a new investor coming to you then and I wanted to invest responsibly in, say, an agriculture project, what would be your sort of key pieces of advice to me moving into that space?
Yeah, so a number of things. The first one is how do you sort of marry the concept of an investment thesis with an investment strategy, because they are clearly different things. An investment thesis is about why does it make sense sort of in the long term to invest in a particular opportunity set, right? And the continent offers a great investment thesis. You know, the notion of the Africa Rising story, the demographic dividend, you know, the new sort of sources of diversification of global supply chains, vast amounts of natural resources and sort of primary type of opportunities, competitive sort of labor costs in the form of, you know, then industrializing those primary opportunities into sort of more secondary and eventually tertiary opportunities. So the investment thesis is very strong, and that's why organizations like us, like Invest Africa, exist. But then in the short to medium term, how do you translate that into an actual sort of attractive investment strategy? And agriculture is a very good example of that. You know, there is no doubt that investing in agriculture in the continent, you know, and sort of feeding, if you will, or catalyzing the green revolution of the continent makes a lot of sense, not only from a financial standpoint, but also from a social and environmental standpoint. But how do you actually make money? You know, what is going to be your investment strategy? And there we've seen that the notion of greenfield investment at scale, which is essentially what a lot of the institutional investors have had to come into because there were no viable sort of projects that already had some minimum level of scale, that greenfield investment strategy has proven to be very challenging. Today, I think we have a lot more choice in what to invest in. So one of the things that we've started to recommend a couple of years ago, and we've actually created an investment vehicle off the back of that called the Third Way Africa Rural Development Corporation, is let's pick, you know, the right projects that already have a minimum level of scale, that are brownfield operations as opposed to greenfield operations. Let's have a proper assessment of value through, you know, a corporate finance skill set. And that may mean that the original sponsors, you know, will have to accept valuations that are below the amount of capital that has gone into those projects. But at least, you know, you're letting the market clear at a fair market value, and bring growth capital to those projects with the right entry point from a valuation standpoint. And then instead of just stopping there, it's saying, okay, you now own or partly own a real asset and have come in at the right price, and you're bringing new growth capital to scale up that real asset. As you scale it up, you're improving the unit economics of your agricultural project, and that is all great and it fits nicely into your investment strategy. But you also need to understand sort of the local context and the geographic, I would say, context of these assets. They will largely be sitting in rural areas with communities living around them, and you need to find a way to interact sustainably with those communities. And so another important part of your investment strategy, or let's say your portfolio or your asset management strategy, is, you know, how do you bring in other forms of partners rather than just commercial investors around those assets, and a form where you can create blended finance opportunities that end up de-risking the proposition for your own commercial capital and potentially enhance their returns, but also make those projects much more resilient in the way that they are, call it, harmoniously integrated with those communities. What does that mean in practical terms? So you invest in a farm, the farm over time scales up, it has a much better understanding over time of what are the right crops to be growing in that area, what are the right practices to kind of have better agronomic performance, essentially to have, you know, less cost and more sort of yield on a per hectare basis. And you can ultimately facilitate all of that knowledge, you know, to the smallholder farmers living around your farm, in a way that maybe not initially, but after a few years, you can also develop a contract farming business around your primary agricultural investment. That is a different investment proposition. It's a finance play rather than an agricultural investment play. But it's another form of revenue. It's diversification, which ultimately is good for the investors. But first and foremost, it's good for the communities living around you. But if you don't have that developmental skill set, it's very difficult for you to kind of think about that sort of additional set of opportunities rather than just being focused on your primary agricultural investment. So that's what I would recommend. It's pick the right investment strategy. Don't just focus on the investment thesis. And then think about what additional levels of skill sets beyond just being a financial investor do you need to ultimately have success in the long term. And that, in our opinion, means, you know, being able to mobilize other forms of ecosystem partnerships, of development partnerships, rather than just commercial capital into your project.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it sounds like the approach you've got sort of really places sustainability and community engagement at the heart of investment, not sort of not an add-on. You know, it's central to the success. And as you were saying, we've definitely seen sort of sustainable investment in the SDGs moving up the agenda over the last few years. I'm curious to get your thoughts about the sort of current situation we're in as with the coronavirus crisis and with the global economy moving into an incredibly difficult period. Whether you think that will undermine some of these sustainable business practices we've been seeing, or actually will the opposite be true and it becomes even more evident that you can only be successful in this sort of community-centered kind of way?
Exactly. No, that's a great question, Eleanor. And I mean, I think I need to sort of caveat my answer with the fact that, you know, I certainly don't have the playbook of how things are going to end up panning out, and I don't think anybody can say that they have either, right? But I of course, I do have thoughts. I think there's a couple of things, you know, positive and negative that we need to highlight about the current context as it relates to Africa. On the negative side, or at least in the sort of the areas for consideration, if you will, I think there has to be a realization that the way that the crisis is being addressed in the short term, and I'm not talking about the healthcare crisis, I'm talking about the sort of the economic impact. It's about pumping money, right? So you're seeing Northern Hemisphere governments, you know, North America, Europe, Asia to a certain extent as well, you know, putting in fiscal and monetary stimulus at unprecedented levels, right? And in a very, very short period of time. That effectively set of tools is much more constrained in the African context because these governments and these central banks, they don't have effectively as much firepower to, if you will, print money or stimulate through kind of fiscal packages, etc., as some of the, you know, the European and the North American governments have, right? So who is going to fill that gap, or who can support in filling that gap? What you do have in Africa is, you know, in relative terms, a notable presence of development actors, right? Whether they're DFIs, multilateral development banks, or development agencies, right? A DFID versus a CDC, a USAID versus a DFC, the World Bank versus the IFC. You have a well-formed ecosystem of developmental support for the private sector and also for governments directly. And that's something that we have seen in the short term. A lot of these organizations have very quickly responded, at least on paper, with an intention to unlock capital very quickly, capital and funding very quickly for Africa for the COVID response. The challenge is going to be the deployment of that funding, right? So the funding has been raised, but, you know, how quickly can it be mobilized, you know, to where it is actually needed, I think is going to be a question that we need to see how it plays out in the next few months, because these organizations obviously have sophisticated and robust, but also, you know, quite slow in some cases, due diligence processes. They have long lists of sort of box ticking exercises that need to be gone through, that you need to go through before you can actually deploy funding, you know, because of governance, etc. And that's important. But unfortunately, there is, you know, a natural timeline to this. You know, once you've reached the peak of the coronavirus and economies start to move from lockdowns into sort of semi-lockdowns and more openness, and we go back to more sort of normality, that's when the money is going to be needed. And that's not going to be a two-year exercise. It's going to be an exercise of a number of months. So how quickly is that funding going to be deployed is clearly going to be a question that we need to follow closely. And at the moment, it's a challenge. So we've participated in a number of conversations around, you know, how can you rethink due diligence in the context of, for example, travel bans, right? And that's something that I think is a lot of people are putting a lot of brain power and resource to as we speak. And hopefully, you know, by the end of the summer, we'll see sort of that capital being deployed at scale and quickly. On the positive side, you have the sort of the rethinking of global supply chains, right? I mean, one of the things that clearly has you know, been at the forefront of some of these geopolitical agendas is, okay, what kind of dependencies did we have in, you know, in economies like the Chinese one, in terms of our supply chain, and how diversified was it or wasn't it? And I think that's something that in the medium term can play to Africa's advantage.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of sort of the supply chains and over-reliance on China, I'd be interested to get your thoughts as well on sort of internal supply chains within the continent, particularly in agriculture, because I know that's somewhere you do a lot of you do a lot of work. Do you see an opportunity here to improve sort of food security and food self-sufficiency and reduce some of the reliance on imports in that space?
Definitely. I think that's something that the COVID-19 crisis has, if anything, sort of put more of a spotlight on. But that question was already there, right? I mean, the organizations like the African Development Bank, with their five sort of strategic goals, and one of them being about, you know, kind of catalyzing in Africa, a green revolution in Africa, have already been thinking about this. They've already been thinking about this for a while. The continent is largely still an importer of food when it actually should be a net exporter. And if we want to feed the planet overall, the last frontier is genuinely Africa, because that's where you have, in relative terms, the most amount of arable land. So whether it was because of COVID in the short term, or, you know, more because of just the demographics at a global level and in the continent in the medium and long term, I think that's a question that was already very much at the forefront of a lot of investors and developmental players. You need, in our opinion, two things, apart from money, right, which is always the key. I think we need to rethink how we interact with smallholder farmers and help people graduate from becoming subsistence farmers to sustainable farmers to mid-scale commercial farmers. And, you know, it's going to be very hard to beat at a cost level a smallholder farmer, right? They will always be the lowest cost producer, right? So how can we unlock rather than just thinking about large-scale commercial farming, how can we unlock smallholders in a more efficient way, in a more effective way into the value chain, and helping them first and foremost increase their productivities, and then secondly also increase the type of price point that they can achieve in the market. If we can do that, I mean, I think the scale is there, right? There's plenty of land and there's plenty of people. So how can we teach people to become better farmers? And the good news is that the bar is very low, right? I mean, productivity levels at the subsistence farming level are shockingly low. You know, let's call it a farmer that is planting maize should be easily achieving yields of 2, 3, 4 tons a hectare, you know, in the medium term. Today, people are achieving yields of, you know, a ton a hectare or less, right? So the bar is quite low, and that in the grand scheme of things is, you know, is good news. But we need to find a way to bring that sort of set of technical capabilities and the access to input so that those more commercial yields can be achieved. And then the second thing is the price point, right? If farmers don't have an ability to tap into a more global price point and a more attractive price point, because they are ultimately at the mercy of having to sell at a very particular point in time because they don't have storage capabilities, so they have to monetize their crop right after harvest, otherwise they're going to lose it, that doesn't put them in a good negotiating position, right? Everybody's trying to sell at the same time, so it becomes a buyer's market as opposed to a seller's market. But if we give people access to infrastructure in the form of silos, for example, then they can sell more linearly throughout the year. So that's about you know, improving resilience in terms of supply chains and food security by thinking about smallholders. And then the other thing, Eleanor, is about overall infrastructure, right? Road access, transportation, you know, trucking companies, silos, as I was referring to, you know, what kind of infrastructure is there also at a processing level to increase sort of that food security consideration? At the moment, you know, a number of projects or areas are still largely stranded from an infrastructure standpoint. So although they may have great potential from, let's call it, a fertility standpoint, a rainfall standpoint, there are areas that are, you know, under infrastructure and they don't have great access to market. So if you cannot sell your crop, then by definition, you're not really in business. So that's the other area that I think needs to be addressed. And then also in a way that is more regionally integrated, right? So how can we think about markets becoming less insular and more regionally integrated? And that's interesting because it has gone a little bit against the short-term realities of COVID. You know, globally, you're seeing countries shut down as opposed to open up. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're a farmer in Malawi, you would like to think that you could potentially be exporting your crop to Mozambique, to Zambia, to Zimbabwe, or potentially even further on, as opposed to just thinking about sort of having to sell in Zimbabwe. And so for that, you also need, you know, regional infrastructure.
And are you feeling hopeful about that process of regional integration? Obviously, you know, we hear a lot about it and there's been a lot of promises made around it. And as you say, you know, with border closures from coronavirus, it's entering a very tricky phase. Just wondering what your outlook is on the African continent of free trade agreement. I'm just still feeling hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think on paper, clearly that has been an aspiration for a while, right? So you have a number of different trading blocks, the Southern Africa level, the Eastern Africa level, Francophone Africa and West Africa, etc. So, you know, the basic infrastructure from a sort of policy and sort of call it architecture, you know, standpoint is already there. We do need physical infrastructure to make That integration more possible. And also we need some sort of financial integration, right? So for example, having regional commodity markets, which in some areas already exists, and then the ability to tap into those regional commodity markets in a way that, you know, your crop starts to become more bankable. So for example, you can get export financing because you are a farming operation, say in Mozambique, that is selling in Malawi. You are recognized as such because you're part of this, regional commodity exchange. You're plugged into that infrastructure, whether it's through silos that are approved, you know, for exporting purposes, etc. And that then allows you to go to a bank and say, okay, I'm an exporter. Because I'm an exporter, I can finance myself in dollars, which means that I can, you know, access a lower cost of financing. So it's not just about the physical infrastructure. It's not just about sort of, you know, import duties and sort of tax integration. It's about the whole, you know, end to end of what is needed, right? Including sort of the financial instruments. But we are seeing, you know, that is certainly improving. Although it's still a bit of a sort of a long-term journey, to be honest. I mean, most of the opportunities that we see from an investment standpoint are to invest in projects that are largely selling domestically or they're selling globally, but not so much regionally.
Because I'm interested to actually delve a little bit more deeply into some of your projects and hear a little bit more about the work you've been doing. So perhaps in relation to coronavirus, and then we can talk more generally. How have you been finding the situation on the ground in some of your own projects?
So maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about the Third Way Africa business model. So we, as a merchant banking platform, we have sort of three pillars to our business. We have an impact consulting business or development consulting business. We have a corporate finance, corporate advisory business. And then we have an investment arm, which is more focused on specific sectors and specific sort of opportunities. And so maybe I'll go through kind of all three of them and talk about what kind of work we're doing and also what kind of challenges and opportunities we're seeing. On the development consulting side, if anything, we've seen an accelerated interest and deployment of resources from development players, development agencies, NGOs, foundations, to address in the short term the coronavirus challenges. So anything from for example, supporting in business planning and capital raising exercises that are being funded by donors to, for example, repurpose manufacturing facilities in different countries for production of PPE, right? Whether it's, masks or things like hand sanitizers, at a local level, right? That needed to happen quickly. And donors were there, you know, as a first port of call to say, okay, how can we help some of these SMEs repurpose themselves? Another one has been, again, still sticking with the sort of the development consulting side of things. How can we think about unlocking, as we were talking about before, some of that funding for COVID relief that has been earmarked at a more micro level so that it's reaching the people that ultimately need it, and in particular SMEs. So SMEs and families. So we're working with a development agency in helping them think about, basically cash transfers, grants to families in a particular area in East Africa that has been affected not only by COVID, but also unfortunately by Islamic insurgency, and there's been sort of significant amounts of IDPs in internally displaced people, and so we're working with an organization to see, okay, how can we leverage mobile money infrastructure, right, mobile wallets, M-Pesas, etc., to get, you know, cash transfers out to families in rural areas. We've also been working with a large, you know, FMCG company in West and North Africa that has, you know, a large network of distributors and retailers sitting sort of in you know, in their platform, that in many cases are small businesses, mom and pop businesses, financially excluded businesses, and our client is probably the closest thing that they have to being financially included. So one thought that we've been working on with our client has been, okay, how can we leverage non-risk adjusted capital, so, you know, development agency and foundation type of funding, in the form of, say, returnable grants that can be deployed through our client that already has that whole distribution and retailer network set up, has 200,000 points of sale, has 100 million customers ultimately interacting with those 200,000 points of sale pretty much on a daily basis. How can we use them as a proxy for cash disbursement to those SMEs? And very similar to what the UK government has done with the business bounce back loans in the UK, where essentially they've said, okay, let's use banks as agents as opposed to as principal risk takers. The government will fully underwrite any potential losses from these loans, but we still need to get them out to people, and for that we need the banking system. So here the thinking was similar. It's instead of governments, it's development agencies and foundations, and instead of banks, it would be large FMCG companies that already have this distribution set out, but the construct would be similar. So that's on the development consulting side. There's been a lot of activity there because people genuinely want to move quickly, and these funds are being sort of earmarked and released. On the corporate finance side, which is about more bankable projects where we're supporting sort of transactions, we've been doing quite a lot of restructuring work. It is going to be a more challenging fundraising environment, but before you can even fundraise, you need to make sure that the right conditions are there, that, you know, companies have the right balance sheets. And clearly with Corona, you know, leverage has increased, right? Because in relative terms, the ability to pay back debt has been impacted. And so we've done quite a bit of work in terms of working with providers of debt, banks, DFIs, et cetera, to see, okay, how can they provide relief by providing sort of more benign long-term and restructured payment terms on existing debt capabilities. And then just finally, on the investment side, as we were mentioning before, a lot of our work has focused on agriculture. And there, I must say, I mean, luckily we haven't been as impacted by COVID in the short term. If anything, you know, as you were saying, food security and maintaining sort of supply chains functioning has been a priority of government. So our projects, you know, on a like-for-like basis have probably benefited from that. We've had some operational challenges, of course, in terms of people's ability to travel and to go to farms, you know, for harvesting, etc. So that has been a little bit of a challenge. But all in all, I think we've been quite fortunate in that, you know, at the moment we don't have capital in sectors like hospitality, for example, that have been more directly impacted. But you know, there's clearly a lot of people out there that have been impacted in the short term because of COVID. I think we luckily less so at an investment level.
And obviously, you know, you mentioned there that in some ways agriculture has been protected because it's, you know, essential, it's an essential service. But there have been sort of, so perhaps some other challenges might have been more relevant to you there then. I'm thinking more about sort of some of the environmental challenges we've seen recently. We've seen, you know, devastating cyclones in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi, and we're seeing sort of locust infestations causing a lot of difficulty. So are your bigger concerns in terms of your agriculture projects actually elsewhere in that sort of longer term environmental challenge?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in fact, this year has been challenging in terms of rainfall for some of the areas that we're in, which has affected sort of crops, etc. I mean, completely unrelated to COVID. And that's always been our concern sort of in the medium to long term, which is, you know, how do you make agriculture more resilient to more climate resilience, right? Both for large scale commercial agriculture, but also for smallholders. And that has to do with essentially a number of things, including access to water and in particular irrigation infrastructure, so that you are less at the mercy of the sort of changes in annual sort of levels of rainfall and the sort of the predictability of when that rainfall is or is not going to come. And so that's I think one area that we've been working on quite a lot. It's expensive because to introduce irrigation to projects costs a lot of money. But it's also an area where you can work closely with development partners to see, okay, how can we create social infrastructure that, you know, will be used by commercial projects, but also by the communities living around them. And then the other thing is crop diversification. Again, not only from an agronomic standpoint in terms of, you know, the climate, soils, etc., but also from a market standpoint, you know, what a global commodity price is doing. It's important to build a portfolio, right, rather than just to be focused on one particular thing. Again, this is if you want to unlock long-term commercial capital and to be able to bring institutional capital into agriculture in Africa, you need to build resilience also at the, you know, at the portfolio level by having, you know, multiple crops as opposed to just having a lot of risk exposed to one particular value chain.
Yeah, and we've covered quite a lot of ground here, you know, actually on the sort of macro level and the key trends in agriculture and sort of global economic challenges. I'm interested just to sort of to end off, what's next for you and Thirdway? What are your sort of ambitions? What are you excited about coming up?
Yeah, well, thanks for the question, because there's quite a lot going on at the moment, which is fantastic. We've already been around for 6 years. We started with an Indian Ocean Africa focus, so Eastern and Southern Africa. And in the first couple of years, quite focused on Mozambique specifically as a country. And I say that for two reasons. One is because a lot of the opportunity set that we're seeing is coming from geographic expansion for us. So as of a year and a half ago, we started to venture into West and North Africa as well. So as of today, the company has worked already in over 20 different African countries. And as I was saying, not only sort of in Indian Ocean Africa. So one big opportunity for us is going to be expansion across the continent and starting to open new offices and more on-the-ground presence. We're exploring currently the possibility of doing something in Nigeria on the investment side, specifically on the agricultural side, which is great. But then also going into our core region where we started, of Eastern and Southern Africa, we're seeing a lot of opportunity there. And in particular, in our first, you know, mother country, if I can call it that, which has been Mozambique, which for anybody in the audience that hasn't visited, it's a fascinating country, very welcoming, very beautiful, but you know that has historically also had its challenges. At the moment, Mozambique is going through a big opportunity for development, largely around an investment in natural resources. So the biggest infrastructure project in the African continent is being developed in northern Mozambique, and that's no small feat. Total is investing in an LNG project in the north of the country, and Exxon is expected to follow suit next year. financial close is being achieved as we speak. And so we're pretty much in live mode. This is a project that is going to absorb multiples in terms of the GDP of the country, the current GDP of the country in terms of foreign direct investment. And so the spillover effects from that are expected to be significant. But it's very important that that lottery ticket, if you will, is monetized in a way that is inclusive, that it brings investment in other sectors, that it builds up the resilience of the country. So we were engaged by the U.S. government, the African Development Bank, the Dutch government, and a number of other sponsors as well, to put together a multi-stakeholder platform for the north of Mozambique, with the aspiration to trigger that inclusive development as a result of the investments in the gas that were happening, that are happening in that country. So we're the secretariat of that platform, and that really is a fascinating project. It's gone from strength to strength. It brings together private sector, civil society, development partners, and the government first and foremost, in one sort of coordination mechanism, which is unlocking different forms of capital in different sectors, not just around the oil and gas project, and that's something that for us, it's been kind of 6 years in the making in some ways, but it's very exciting to see that all of this is now coming to fruition, and we are using that multi-stakeholder approach in many other things that we're now doing in the continent. So that's also very, very exciting for us. And then I think lastly, across the three businesses, the asset management side is something that in relative terms we're expecting to grow, even faster than the other businesses in the next few years. So that's something that, we encourage people to stay tuned, because we, in the next year or two, I think we're going to come up with a number of new vehicles in different areas beyond agriculture and rural development, which has been our kind of core focus on the investment side to date.
Great, thanks. And just to close off, I'd like to ask people to very briefly pick, I think I might be able to guess what yours might be, one sector and one country that they think are sort of ones to watch in the next year or so.
Yeah, so I think in our case, the country, we have to say Mozambique, just because of what I just said. But also geopolitically, it's a country that is very much on the agenda of a lot of international players. And so in relative terms, it's been a bit stop and go in the last few years. But now, it's going to go through an unprecedented level of growth. So, and it's a country that has largely been underinvested in the last few years. There's a number of others that I would highlight. But if I have to pick one, I would encourage people to start refocusing on Mozambique. In terms of sector, maybe you were going to expect me to say agriculture, but I think we've talked quite a lot about that in this podcast. So I'm going to throw a bit of a curveball here and talk about climate smart mining and strategic minerals. With the advent of sort of the energy revolution and mobility in the form of electric vehicles, lithium ion batteries is a space that is going to see exponential growth in the next few years. Right, we're going to need a lot more energy storage than we've ever needed before. But you cannot drive a Tesla without a battery, and you cannot have a battery without having a set of sort of critical minerals that come into the anode and the cathode of that battery. So we've been doing quite a lot of work in that space in minerals like graphite. And it's a fascinating area, because the next frontier for where those resources are sitting is Africa. People are looking to diversify out of China for, you know, a number of obvious reasons, including in China, you know, those resources in some cases are dwindling. And so Africa is very much the next frontier for a lot of these minerals. But there's a real opportunity to bring in development players to kind of help de-risk some of these projects. Initiatives like the Climate Smart Mining or Minerals for Climate Action initiative of the World Bank, which, you know, to throw a plug in there, is fantastic, and they're supported by a number of mining companies, but also European governments, being led out of DC, is something that I encourage people to look into. They've done a lot of research and have started to support a number of governments in frontier markets and emerging markets to see how they can effectively extract value out of those mineral resources, but in a way that in the medium term, they capture more and more of that value across the value chain. So moving from, you know, upstream mining to also downstream processing, and ultimately potentially starting to have what are called gigafactories. So, you know, lithium ion battery factories in the continent. And so that I think is going to be an interesting opportunity to keep an eye out in the continent.
So thanks so much for taking the time to speak to me today. It's been really interesting and a pleasure to talk to you. If people want to find out more about Third Way Africa, they can visit your website, thirdwayafrica.com, and they can also find you on Twitter and LinkedIn. Is that right? And anything else to add? Great. Gonzalo, thank you so much. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to Best Africa Insights for more conversations with the continent's business leaders.
Thank you very much, Eleanor. It's been a pleasure.